there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Quare. Yeah. How are you?
A special uncertainty edition of Shop Talk Show.
Yeah, we're at day 9,000 of the electoral process here in America, so we're getting through it all. So anyway, hey, but that's not what this show's about. So we're about websites. Chris, you seen a website before?
Yeah, it's a lot. So much is going on. So many website things. I like how we just have a kind of a talk show vibe to this thing. You know, in the past, I get in like the mood for SEO like twice a year, where I'm like, I should care about SEO. Yeah. You know, like that probably matters to some degree. And what really matters is like how you title things and the quality that you write. And I don't know, like I just know from experience on CSS Tricks, if we write an article that's like how to do this, and it's a really nice, clear article with good content, that it will just do good SEO wise for a long time to come, you know? And then sometimes my thinking goes so far to this show, I'm like, we should do shows like that. Why? Because then people will like look for a podcast, and it'll be, and then that feeling doesn't last very long. Cause it's just on a commute today, and I looked through like 10 tech podcasts, and they're all good. Like I like them for all different reasons, but some of them were like, one was like, let's dig into TypeScript or something. And I looked at the time, I was like, I don't want to dig into TypeScript right now, you know? So I thought that it's kind of nice that this show is more just like, I don't know, we talk about a bunch of topics each time so that each show is like equally listening to a
lot. Not today, Satan. No. yeah. It's we have the potpourri methodology. I wonder though, if somebody was like, here's what you need to do. And we just had like, the expert, what's his name from Gimlet Media, came by and said, I'm Alex. I think they're all named Alex. I'm Alex. Here's what you need to do.
Yeah, like I wouldn't. It is tempting to have some advice on stuff like that, you know, especially like constant content strategy style advice. Like, is there good answers to this? I sort of suspect that there's not, much like politics, that it's ever evolving. And it's like kind of a moving target of what's the best way to do it. I think the classic is, you know, have really wonderful content. You know, it's like if you're This American Life and you just knock it out of the water every week, it kind of doesn't matter what you do. You could have a crappy naming convention and who cares? People are still going to listen to it because it's good.
Yeah, I think too, though, they have huge budgets. And not that we couldn't have a huge budget, but I think they have huge budgets, you know, and all those stories are, you know, I think.
What do you think it takes on average to produce a TAL show? 100 grand?
100 grand a piece, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, because you're paying more, somebody maybe, like 10, let's say, whatever, 10 grand, I don't know, like a reporter, 10 grand to go out and report things or something for X number of months, however long they do it. They have to fly places. Then you have to pay Ira Glass to sit down and record things. That costs you at least 10 grand.
Like, yeah. You got the whole office staff.
Pay an editor and ad sales and all this stuff. Like, I mean, yeah. I think it just goes through the roof. But at least 10 grand. But I've noticed with Gimlet, they'll have like Reply All, which is something I listen to here and there. Like they'll have really in-depth episodes, and then they'll have kind of cheapos, you know, sort of like let's sit down with our boss and show a meme to him or whatever that he doesn't understand, and everyone laughs, and it's good content. But yeah, it's like, you know, that's probably their filler episode for the like more expensive episode. Yeah. So I think they're doing anything cool, it's they're cracking the, here's an easy, cheap and easy episode, and here's an expensive episode. So they have a good balance of that.
So. All right. Well, there's a little inside podcast baseball. Dave and Chris have no answers, as usual. No. Let's do one that where we might have an answer, although I don't know that we will. Rory O'Connor writes in about third-party scripts. Like, so he says, like many, I need to load a lot of third-party scripts. For example, my analytics scripts, my script that powers my reviews, some tracking scripts I need to run on my sites. Google PageSpeed Insights That's interesting. Is that a thing? Is that the same as Lighthouse or are they different?
They use Lighthouse now. Yeah.
Okay. Now it's Lighthouse. Is complaining that these scripts are blocking the main thread, even though the async attribute is being used in all the script tags. What am I missing? Do you guys have any advice or best practices for pushing scripts that are not essential to the page's core content and functionality to the very end, and also satisfying our Google overlords, as in Google PageSpeed Insights / Lighthouse overlords?
This is tough. I mean, I think this is the big challenge for any business. And this is something we try to help companies with, but they're very reticent, I think is the right word, to like let go of these tracking scripts or the, you know, they have to have Google Analytics and HubSpot, and they have to have, you know, whatever user replay or whatever it is. They have to have kind of these like four, you know, Facebook pixels, Twitter pixels.
Okay, so
stuff like
let's
that.
Say you so have to have them. What do you, is it just impossible then to please Lighthouse? Or like, in my mind, isn't it like you put them at the bottom of the page? Maybe you not only use async, but maybe even defer, I don't know. Like well, if they're totally non-essential.
Some of them have like good embed codes, but some like Google Analytics, they're like, we want to be after the head right now is their kind of current convention, like the first tag in the body, basically. But then they want like, you know, but I've noticed with like Google Tag Manager and Google DoubleClick, it will drop your frame rate to whatever, 10 frames a second. It'll like throttle the main thread to do all of its little setup and calculation sort of stuff. So that's just to say, like, you know, I feel conflicted because I get a lot of advice from Google people and they're like, you gotta make your website fast, you know, and then you're like, cool, I did that, but then it's your script. And they're like, that's another department. Sorry, dude. And so you're like, well, what do I do? You know? So it's just tough, but I think that's where the concept of budgets come in, right? Like, I mean, if you know you have these 10 scripts, like you get less images and less JavaScript. I mean, you know, I think that's, it's sort of like a family.
That's a nice way to think about it. Yeah. I mean, that's the budget. Whole point of those. Yeah.
You know, and if somebody's like, why can't we have a cool homepage? You're like, 'cause we have too many, too much junk in the trunk, you know, like we can't, yeah, you know,
the performance story is interesting. I don't, you know, we can complain about Google Analytics or whatever, but I don't ever see Google Analytics as being the cause of actual pain on websites. You know, like you might, you could complain about the, I don't know, the fact that you're being tracked and you could get tinfoil hatty about it. That's fine. You know, be as tinfoil hatty as you want, but it's not like I'm like, well, my page had scroll jank and then I removed Google Analytics and now it doesn't anymore. Like, I've never heard a story like that. You know, I have heard that about like Optimizely or something that has some janky A/B test swap or something that actually has negative performance implications. That's why I've kind of been a fan of, at least conceptually, of Google's Core Vitals thing, where they're saying it's not just like, they're not measuring how many requests you have and dinging you that you have too many requests. They're measuring actual stuff like first input delay. How long is it until you can do something to an input? And cumulative layout shift, which is like, is there janky stuff moving around as your page loads? Yes, you get dinged for that, you know? And the what's the other one? The largest contentful paint or something, which is like, chances are this is like the biggest, most important thing that users care about on the page. So we're going to measure that for you. Now, these are generic and they're algorithmic. So you do have to care about them because Google's also telling you that these are related to SEO. So those matter. But I'm glad they exist because they matter so much more than just like, I'm going to go to war with my website and get it from 45 requests to 40 requests. That probably is going to help in some way, but it's totally abstract how it's going to help. It's not going to help in, you mean, it'd be much more being like, oh, there's this weird shift when my page loads. I'm going to go to war with that. And if you win that, that has obvious immediate value directly to your users and then abstractly to your SEO. And that's awesome. That seems cooler to me than going to, I'd rather fight real wars than abstract wars, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. I'm listening to a book called Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. And I probably need to read it again. But it's kind of like your own personal life, right? Like, it's like, quit Facebook, quit Twitter, you know, take a break from them, like, fast, or detox from it and stuff like that. And so, and like, that's cool. Right now I'm on Twitter for my job. Like, basically, you know, it's how I keep up to date, and it's a tool that I'm using, but like, how do you prevent it from being a tool that burdens you, you know? And that's, I mean, again, I'm in the same with like email. Like, it's a tool that helps you do your job, but it's also like a tool that if you get 10 emails a minute, like, it's a distraction, you know?
Oh, this is good stuff. I want to know what you learned. I have a question that I'd like an answer from, you know, like, if you stumble across something, I'd love to hear it from you. But so I feel the same way. Like, I don't feel like Twitter is a total net negative for me, because I have good conversations there. I get good ideas there. I stay informed there. There's some customers there. Like, it's a little abstract sometimes, but overall, I get some value out of that particular one. I almost never get value when I open Facebook, but that's because I haven't curated it to a business lifestyle. It's literally still just like a bunch of people from high school that we've followed, and I see pictures of their kids that I've never met, and I'm like, okay. So I don't open that one very often. But Twitter, fine. It's usually a quick hit of, you know, like, some news. Ah, great. At work, I don't find it that bad. Like, I still get a bunch of work done, and then sometimes I just need a little mental break. I click over to the Twitter tab, I click a few things, and it largely feels fine. Where it doesn't feel fine is that I come home from work and I sit down on the couch, my kids playing blocks or something, and I'll still do it. I'll still grab my phone and I'll still look at Twitter. And then the value is over. Very rarely am I like engaging with important stuff at that point. At that point, it feels like an addiction. It feels like I'm having a smoke. You know,
it is like, and like, all these products were designed to be addictive. Like, that's their whole design. There's like documents, you know, Facebook's own research is like, man, this like button sure is hella addictive. Like there's like actual, you know, psychological.
So how
things
do I do it? Like, it's one thing to be like, I should be more engaged with my little girl playing blocks right now. And it's not like I'm not ever. It's not like I'm a terrible dad, but I'd love to be this like perfect dad who like is 100% engaged with the block playing and never reaches for his phone ever.
Yeah, you know, I'm not good at it either. And even when my kids like, oh, I'm dad, and they'll like pick up a thing and pretend it's a phone or whatever, and it's like, oh, that sucks. So, you're like, oh, yeah, well, okay. But, you know, it's also like my brain, I need to like check out of work. I need to like downtime, you know, like not everything's like 100%. Like, you got to take care of yourself in the middle of a pandemic, especially. But, you know, there's like a few strategies. I mean, one is like throw your phone across the room, like don't have it on your body, like chuck it in the room, put it in your bedroom, like not the room you're hanging out in. And that's like one way to dodge the compulsion to check, you know, and then one way to dodge the, like, you know, I looked at the clock and whoops, now I'm on Twitter, and whoops, you know, now I'm mad about politics or whatever. Like if you can just divorce yourself physically from the device, that's, you know, like a big thing. And I think the other key is like setting intentions, which I'm not good at, you know, that's what I'm learning is like, this, like, write down the value that you get from Twitter. Like, I get some friendship and I get some things, and then that's what you use it for. If you find yourself going outside of that fence, you just say, oh, this is not worth it. There's maybe some other.
You really got to codify it then, like, literally maybe write it.
Yeah, just like, this is what I get, you know, and, you know, I like puppy photos, like, those are cute or whatever. I don't need to follow an account that does that. Like, I, it's not that, I don't know. I don't need that, you know, and I probably am heading towards a place where I need to unfollow everybody and rebuild the people I follow. Not because I don't like these people or whatever. It actually brings me a lot of joy, but it's almost too much noise, you know? And so I probably just need to like mow things down and scale it all back, you know? And that's tough because like it feels like you're missing out on people, but it's more like just like I have to, it's out of hand. So again, I'm like checking Twitter when I like, you know, no one, you know, I'm waiting for somebody to post something cool, you know, that. And I mean, if you've ever used Mastodon, like that's its problem is no one's on it and no one posts regularly. So you know, you don't use it because no one posts regularly, you know?
Yeah, like, right. You also don't hear people being like, oh, my LinkedIn addiction is crazy.
Oh,
you
know? Dude, like, I was on LinkedIn yesterday. Just, oh,
man, 2 in the morning, crazy. Just LinkedIn it in, you know?
Staring at LinkedIn,
which
yeah.
proves the point of how it's, I mean, I'm sure they would like to, maybe they've just tried and failed, but to make it as addictive as the other ones are, you know?
Well, no, I mean, that's it. You set the intention around what you're going to use. I'm going to use LinkedIn to get a new job. That's like it, right? Like you don't, your whole life isn't invested in getting a new job. Maybe it is if you're like hustling or whatever, but like, that's what I'm going to use it for. Facebook, I'm going to use it to connect to people to high school. That's all you use it for. Unfortunately, Facebook does track you around the internet. So you got to think about that. But, and I honestly, I want to delete it. I just haven't, you know, I'm like quasi worried about all these old relationships or whatever, but
me too. Yeah. I haven't got all the way to the deleteometer there.
Friends are Pokemon you catch along the way and you have to catch all the friends. And that's what yeah. Facebook is for.
And then I'm also like, people. Is it so bad if I just like do a sticky post or something that says like, hey, I don't check this, but I like all of you still, all good. Here's my blog where I actually do write stuff. Here's Twitter where I engage a little bit more than here. And so like, at least it's like, whatever, you have a presence there. But then yeah. like, that's not exactly sending Facebook a message that says your shit is not okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's how do you send that signal? Even like deactivation is like, that's what my wife did because she was spending too much time on it. She didn't like where it was going. She's getting wrapped up in friends of friends, you know, sisters of friends' lives and on Facebook. And so she just was like, yeah, I'm done with this, you know.
I heard a crazy one today about, this is hard to know. There's a lot of ins and outs, not an expert, not a lawyer, not nothing here, just. I saw it on a podcast. It was a Freakonomics episode, I think, where he was talking to some various political experts. But so sometimes, I think Twitter's done this and Facebook has done this. Is I think Twitter stopped doing political advertising at all, right? Like 100%.
And I mean, to some degree, yeah, I think.
Like, I mean, it might be tricky. Yeah. Maybe they slip some through, or there's caveats or something. And Facebook didn't, but did in the week up to the election. But whatever the pundit/expert that was on the show, was saying that that's tricky because if you do what advertising can be, whatever you might think of it, is like a way to even the field sometimes. So whatever the biggest platforms are on the platform, as soon as you stop all advertising, whatever the biggest one in then gets the biggest megaphone. And on mm-hmm. Facebook, the biggest groups, the highest engagement and all that stuff by far is right-wing stuff. So the second you stop all advertising, then there's no more tools for left-wing stuff to kind of balance that out. So whatever. And that could go the opposite on other platforms. It was a talking point that I found pretty interesting that it seems like very clap-worthy, like, oh, they did it. No political advertising. The world is sane again. Good job. Rub your shoulders. Is almost an action of, you know, like, oh, they're throwing one to the right on this platform.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. No, I'm very cynical of the whole like advertising model or whatever, but it's just, you know, you don't get to make money for like 10 years and then you're like, oh, 1 week we turned it off. Yeah, we did it. We saved democracy. You know, like you don't get the credit. I'm sorry. I just like you can't take disinformation bucks and then be like, oh, well, we stopped doing it for 1 week. You know, it's like I stopped murdering for 1 week, so I guess I'm not a murderer. Well, so sorry. I'm just
harsh, anyway, harsh. Yeah.
Extreme opinions there, but you know. See, I'm not a serial killer.
I just heard a lot of clapping over that, and it was interesting to hear another perspective where it can be just as dangerous. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Jetpack, you know, the WordPress plugin that brings all sorts of cool features and power to your self-hosted WordPress site. I use it on all of my self-hosted WordPress sites because it has an absolutely super compelling feature set. Let's talk specifically about Jetpack Backup. Now, I just said Jetpack has a bunch of features. That's been like almost like a criticism of Jetpack from people in the past. That's too much stuff. I don't need all that stuff. You don't have to use any of it at all. Jetpack Backup is sold totally independently of all that stuff, right? So if you just want backup because you know you want really good backups for your WordPress site, which of course is tremendously important, you cannot be losing your production data on a site. That's absolutely unacceptable. You need a robust backup solution. This is the best one there is for WordPress. For $10 a month or $96 a year, you got Jetpack Backup going on. It's like WordPress itself backing up WordPress. So your backups are on WordPress.com. You go to WordPress.com, you can see a log of what's happening, things that have changed, and roll back or download your backups at any point. That's the daily backups. It's awesome. They also offer for $50 a month or $480 a year real-time backups. So like as things are happening on your site, you see that activity log and you can back up to like any point. Like, ooh, something went wrong right here. I need to restore right to that point. You can one click do that. So not only are they backups, but they help you restore those backups as you need to as well, which is super cool and super powerful. And you can download them as well, move them somewhere else. So it's like the best possible backups you can do, you know, for your production website. And it's everything. It's like the themes, all the PHP code that powers the site, and the database, which is trickier to back up, and all the media too, which is a super big deal and can be quite large, you know. It's everything, the whole ball that just makes it possible to, you know, totally restore your site to a spot. I don't know, just it's, you got to have it, you know? And so this is just a backup solution, happens to be under the Jetpack brand, but is totally a la carte. So if you need nothing else, which would be crazy to me, but whatever, that's how Jetpack Backup works. Thanks for the support. All right, let's do another question. Kim Dauber writes in and audioed in too. Maybe we can patch that in.
Hi, Dave and Chris. So as a reasonably skilled web developer, I get lots of unsolicited contact from recruiters, especially on LinkedIn. It's about 2 to 3 per week. What is the deal with those? Do people actually get jobs from them? There are so many, it's hard to tell if any of them are even legitimate. For context, I'm not explicitly in the market for a new job right now, but I like to keep an ear to the ground. Thanks.
Kim's getting some job offers, unsolicited job offers from LinkedIn. What's the deal?
That's kind of the point of LinkedIn, isn't it? Like, sorry, yeah. Kim, but it's like you have a professional presence there, and their whole thing is stay connected with other developers, particularly when you're looking for work. It's like the number one place for solving your unemployment as a professional, you know? I think they do a pretty good job of it because that's, you know, they're a huge, huge successful company. Now, yeah, is it annoying? Yeah, hell yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know. People don't like it. I hear more jokes about recruiters on LinkedIn than almost any other tech joke. It's second only to IE6 jokes.
I mean, you know, there's quality, right? Like, you know, hi, Kim, do you want a Java job? And you're like, I do JavaScript. So that's probably a no, you know? I mean, I think it's just the economics. Like, recruiters get paid by how many people they reach out to or how many leads they generate, you know? Or if they actually get paid if they sign a deal, they get like a percentage match based on the hire or whatever.
Oh, so, it can be tons too. I think it's kind of spam because it's unsolicited and whatever, but I think you probably signed some and checked some checkbox that said this is okay with you at some point. So I don't think there's any laws being broken. And yeah, does it work? It totally works. I know tons of people who get headhunted, as they say, and move from one company to another company because they engage with recruiters and stuff. I largely think it's a thriving industry. Like that's a lot about how people move. They engage with these people and they actually get good offers and they move around. Now, are most of these that you get probably good offers? No, probably not. They're probably a bad target. They're probably weird companies that you don't want to work for. Who knows if you'd even get the job? You know, it's not exactly a job offer. They're just playing the numbers game.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, I think too, as tech employees, our salaries tend to be higher than average. And so we're like bigger fish, you know? And so if they can land one tech job, that's like worth two, three, like more menial hires, you know? And so, and I use that in a terrible sense, but just like whatever lower intro jobs. So like if they can hire a senior developer, it's better than like two juniors or something. I don't know. So I think there are ways though that you can use this for yourself. And like, I've done that too, like know your value, you know, you can extract your value from them. You're like, cool. Hey, thank you. I'm not looking right now, but give me some stats, you know, just press them and they may not respond, but like, you know, what are you paying? Where's the location? Like, is it remote? I'm not looking now, but maybe I could circle back if I'm ever like looking, you know, and maybe you know, people are like, oh, we'll pay you $35 a year. And you're like, well, glad I didn't even engage them. You know, if they're offering a salary that's higher than your salary, you know, maybe that's something to consider, you know, like get numbers, like get wages and, you know, get information that you don't have about yourself, figure out what your market value is. You know, I think mm-hmm. there's ways to extract that and, you know, maybe it's like misleading people along, but, you know, just say like, hey, you know, my time's important, you know, I'm not, you know, but so what are you paying and where's it at and what's the expectations? And, you know, maybe you can take that information when you go to negotiate at your job for a raise. You can be like, well, down the street, they're paying, you know, 10, 20K more. So what do I do? You know, that's maybe something you could do. So,
yeah. So I don't get the sense that Kim is like, yeah, in the like, I don't like this. Like, can you explain to me where this weird spam comes from?
Yeah, it sucks and it's weird. And like, it's like just noisy because like these probably aren't all quality. But, you know, if you just have like a boilerplate like response to these people, like, I think that works out the best. That's what I do. I just send it like, I'm not looking for, thank you so much for thinking of me. I'm not currently looking to change my position, but if you have any, like information I need to know, like let me know or something, you know, just boilerplate sort of response. I think that goes a long way. You don't like close doors,
yeah.
You know, cause you wouldn't want to be like flame them and just be taken off this whole like email list. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe you do, you know, but like, and I do that too. It's like, you know, I'm very much like, just, you have to tell me numbers. So like, just tell me numbers. And if you can't do that, and I'm sure people just shut the door. They're like, that guy's greedy. So, and that's okay. Like, peace out. So
sometimes it makes me sad a little bit. I hear a lot of how much recruiter stuff people get nailed with, and, you know, see, like from lots of people, it's really common. And I just don't get it. Like I feel left out, Dave. I feel sad. Where's my recruiter spam? I never get recruited for nothing. I got two messages on LinkedIn and I don't even have a joke profile. I have a real profile on LinkedIn where I'm wearing a tie and I have all my real information on my stuff. And I have one message from this whole month. One is sponsored, some nonsense that doesn't make sense. And another one is some person who sent me a very generic email about their WordPress plugin and how it works with Touch ID or something. That's it. Mm. That's all I got from LinkedIn.
Well, I don't even have a LinkedIn. I actually, so maybe I'm the worst advice, but I do get emails to my personal email, which is like, how'd you even find this? You know, but like, I don't put it on my website. I don't put it, you know, but it's just kind of like, man, like I, you know, but I do, it's probably, I don't know. It's like one a month and then, one every 6 months or 3 months, 4 months that what you're like, well, then I've at least heard of this company, you know? So I don't know. So I don't know, but I, if you don't like it, I think, you know, maybe I'm trying to think like what the situation you could do, but I would try to extract as much value as you can, come up with a boilerplate response and say, thanks for thinking of me, not.
Probably, yeah. Now. That's good. Don't burn any bridges. I know a guy in the Valley who, I'd say it's a hobby, but it's not really. It's just professional acumen, I guess. Interviews all the time, wherever he's at.
Really?
Every month he'll go for an interview with somebody else. Yeah, totally. Just to feel like, hey, what's out there? Keep skills sharp and all this stuff. It's like a nice lunch break, I guess, because there's so many companies so close to each other that maybe it's not that hard to just pop on the train or whatever, just pop into somewhere just kind of for funsies. And maybe you're like, get good at it, because first of all, you get good at anything that you do. But two, you know, you're not thirsty for the job. So you can just like, I absolutely don't care if I bomb this because I have a job, you know?
No, I mean, experience is probably huge, you know, like just that interviewing experience, even whiteboard interviews and stuff like that. Like, so you're not just like sweating, like when you do that, probably smart.
So. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. Luke wants to know about the ARM based Silicon Macs, which, are not even out there.
There's not a even demo model for the like Mac. What's the MacBook Pro? No, the little, not the iMac, but the little like
The little home one.
Little Mac square Mini. Boy Mac Mini. That's it. Yeah, there's like a demo Mac Mini unit. But they think like maybe next week there might be an Apple announcement about Silicon Mac, you know, new ARM based Macs. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Is your computer ARM or whatever?
No, it's not. Mine's Intel x86 based.
I don't even know what it means. What is ARM?
It's like a CPU architecture. Like the Intel or x86 architecture is kind of for your classic desktop based computers. Mm-hmm. And the ARM architecture is for mobile devices. And so it's a lot more power efficient. So like putting it into a laptop theoretically will extend the life of your laptop. Like it's optimized the way I've heard it explained, and I could be totally wrong on this, but the way I've heard it explained is ARM is optimized for very short tasks, and the x86 is optimized for kind of longer kind of tasks and stuff like that.
So I wonder if we're going to have a choice. It seems weird that all MacBook Pros would go to this architecture. I mean, the battery life is nice. I'm not going to say no to that, but it would suck to have to take a hit in performance.
You should be fine. Like, cause you know, in this long and short is computer time. It's not like even human time. You know what I mean? Like, so that's something to think about. Like I don't think you're going to suffer performance. In fact, those like A14 chips or whatever that are in the
iPads,
apparently they're jacked. Like they you know, it's pushing 120 hertz screen, or that's maybe the GPU, but like, they're putting out a lot, you know, of calculation in physics on the UI and stuff like that. Like they do a lot of stuff. And in Luke's question, he says, I'm due to upgrade my MacBook, but I have concerns over compatibility of common software like VS Code and Figma. And that second part is kind of the crucial part, because that's the part where this architecture change messes things up. So, last year, and you can look up videos on The Verge or whatever, the Surface Pro X or something like that came out, and it's ARM based, right? All the reviews are like, this is very cool, but a lot of the software doesn't work on this.
Yeah, you get great battery life because you don't run anything.
Nothing works. So there was a lot of like, you know, haterade on that, you know, but it was very much like we're going to try to do this. And how Microsoft is doing it in Windows is, you know, if you can compile to this target, they want you to compile to the ARM target. But they have a emulator, basically, just like when Mac switched to PowerPC back in the day, or back from PowerPC over to Intel, they had an emulator for a bit. There's an emulator that they can run Intel software on the ARM chip. So, but it was like mixed bag. you know, and even, but some software has been migrated over to work on ARM chips. And that's like Adobe's kind of already pioneering this.
Okay.
And then a lot of the Windows apps have like ARM compilations. So the
Windows story is getting better.
Windows story is getting better. And one thing about the Macs, and they control, because through the App Store and the Xcode and everything, they actually control the code authoring of native apps as well, right? Mm. So like that, those like work pretty good because they like control the whole system. So they should, it should be a better situation than Windows even, I would say, because Windows has a lot of legacy apps, you know?
Yeah.
Like, apps that have been working for 20, 30 years, you know, like in Macs are very frequently, even iOS is like, well, that doesn't work anymore. Sorry, you have to upgrade or what, you know. Like,
right, yeah.
They're very comfortable.
Fortnite, for example.
Fortnite, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But there's no freaking way Apple's going to ship a computer where VS Code doesn't run on it. It's like not happening, you know.
And that's the thing, too, is those are actually Electron apps. So...
Oh,
just the shell has to work. And so browsers, Chrome works on ARM and works on.
I forgot VS Code is Electron. People used to crap on Electron, but now they can't anymore, right? Because VS Code is so good.
So the two that Luke mentions, Code and Figma specifically, are actually going to work, should work pretty well. I mean, unless there's like some weird plugin or process that requires some sort of binary,
right,
that requires some sort of thing, but it should all just work. And even if it has a binary,
Slack will work too. And yeah, so we'll be fine that way.
Toolbar, Notion, VS Code, Slack, Spotify, like everything. Zoom,
and anything that's a web app will work too if you just use it through your browser.
Yeah. So I think like I don't, you know, there's always the like don't buy the first gen motto, you know. Which is maybe smart, you know, but
there's a couple in my doc that I'd worry about. There's like CodeKit. I don't use that very much, but that's very like to the metal, like watching files, processing stuff. I mean, who knows where that is at? Local by Flywheel runs all my WordPress sites. That seems dangerous-ish. Can't lose that. See, it's like, it's almost like you got to wait for these things to come out. Get the compatibility story, which there'll be news outlets and stuff covering that, right? There's probably, somebody's probably already bought like, will it run on my MacBook.com or whatever.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm like excited for new MacBooks, but that is scary. Hasn't this happened once before too? Apple switched at one time to the, when they switched to the IBM chips or whatever that was. I can't remember.
Yeah, that was around Tiger, I think. Or Leopard or something, but yeah, they switched to Intel based Macs in like 2004 or five or something, and then they switched to, but even before that, from the OS 9 to OS X upgrade, OS 9 to
Unix
OS 10,
or whatever, that was weird too.
Yeah, it was like from Mac OS to like some Unix based system, and so that was like a big switch. But they had the emulator in place, and so I bet Apple will have an emulator for all this old software, so it'll kind of run, but it'll run with like, hey, this is running in old mode, you know. So, but I bet it works.
So we'll get the story. I think it's soon. By the time this
next
comes
week,
out, maybe
the day after this comes out, maybe I think there's
and there's you know. The story from Apple will be, this is the greatest thing that's ever, 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 ever happened.
And so they'll show software that most certainly works and has been piloted, and they're going to show all that stuff. Your stuff, however, might be a totally different story. I mean, how many like weirdo apps do you have? You know, like, I mean, I don't know. I use an image compression app on Windows called Riot, and it's, swear to God, it's from 1997. I mean, it's just, it's old as sin. It looks terrible, but it's like, functions like a workhorse, you know, and that's my image compressor, you know.
Cool.
Does a good job, but like, does that work on ARM? Probably not. I don't know.
I don't know. Might have to upgrade, man. That's funny. Use an ancient image compressor. Wow, you'd think that like there's new image compression stuff out regularly enough that wouldn't work. Does it get updated?
It gets updated. I mean, it's just kind of has like the algorithms. It's pretty upgraded. It just like the UI is very old. Like it's the very legacy UI, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like classic Windows, like all the, you know, you get into the utilities and all of a sudden you're in like XP, you know, Windows XP. You're just like, golly, man, this is not cool. Meanwhile, Mac, it's like, hey, you want an eyedropper utility? Dude, look at it. It's totally fluid physics and blah, blah. You know, the eyedropper sucks up a little.
You're almost
pixel
like when you get into the utilities, you almost get better UI.
And there's a lonely sandwich or whatever that dude's name video. You know, he's like, today I'm introducing the pixel sucker, you know, it pulls one pixel from your screen and gives you a hex code.
It's and then beautiful. Like a hot dog walks by and it's funny and everybody laughs.
What was that? I don't know, but you can color sample it. You know, like that's it. Like that's just none of that going on in Windows Land. We're a little bit more thrifty, a little more to the metal.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of to the metal, we have a sponsor, Equinox Metal. Let me tell you about that. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Equinix Metal. They didn't say to say metal like that, but you kind of have to, I feel like, because it's pretty metal anyway as a product. So Equinix is the world's digital infrastructure company. They have this brand new product, Equinix Metal. Fully automated, bare metal as a service gives you the freedom to build any way you want, anywhere you want it. So this is digital infrastructure, as they say. These are you're buying servers here to run your stuff, you know? So this is something you reach for when you know you need some infrastructure to power the thing that you're building. And you want something that's like good and that like has developers in mind for real. So they're kind of like a bunch of developers over there where like, you know, I see what's happening in digital infrastructure. We're going to like start over and do it better and do it ourselves. And that's what happens here. It's like a for developers by developers infrastructure product. For one thing, it's info.equinix.com. /shop talk that just go there and just put your name and they give you $100 to try it anyway. So if you just want to play around, you know, you have some incentive to do that. So thanks to them for that. $100 info.equinixmetal.com/shop talk. And it'll be in the show notes, of course, to just add metal, they say, which is awesome. This isn't necessarily for like, I need a server for my personal blog or whatever. I mean, like you could probably do that if you want the world's most metal badass personal blog, but it's like you're buying server, real servers to do big work, you know? And we're talking global data centers here, you know? They have 220 little physical data centers around the world. Pretty awesome. So this is serious digital infrastructure for your products. Check them out. Thanks for the support. Let's see. What else do we have to talk about today? We don't have Jeremy on to do another chapter just this episode, but more chapters of our web history series are being published by Jay. So I imagine there'll be some in the future. And you know that was a part, what that was, where it originated, wasn't like, let's get Jeremy Keith to read awesome stories for us. It was Dave and I reaching out to anybody to read anything, essentially, not just, you know, anyway, we reached out to some people we thought had some good writing or were good readers or whatever to do that. But I can't guarantee anything to anybody listening, but I like the idea, and this was Dave's idea originally, was to get people to read great blog posts on the show as an interesting segment. Because it's just cool. It's kind of like, you know, getting Mike Birbiglia to read his little thing about his kid or whatever on a podcast.
Yeah, it's
cool.
Like old, like, I don't know. There's some classic web pieces and it'd be cool to have them captured on audio, you know? So
so that happened. You know. If you really want to do it, feel free to email us and be like, this is an awesome blog post, either of my own or of somebody else's, probably preferably in my history of things on the web. I think chances are that it's going to turn out better if you're trying to promote somebody else than yourself. But you know,
reach out to us. We'd love to hear. Hey, speaking of money, which we just read an ad, web monetization is back, baby.
I was just writing about it a little bit. There has been new chatter. Did I post on it today?
That's what I saw. But you're posted about the Leonie Watson article, where she switched over to Coil, to monetize her blog. But one thing that's like critical from Naomi's perspective is I hadn't considered were like the accessibility benefits of non-intrusive advertising, you know?
Yeah.
And it got me kind of hyped up about it again. And, you know, my story with like XRPs is not that great. You know, I think I've made $40 over the last year and a half, and I've put in, you know, probably $80 or something. I don't know.
You're a net negative on the
negative, but yeah. I've in theory paid out money to people, and that's fine or whatever.
Right.
I'm not making money. But one thing that's cool about this, it just, you know, you get into ads and usually it's like a accessibility nightmare. It's a trap. It's an iframe inside of a page. And you're just like, how do I skip it? Or it's making noises or animating or whatever. So I hadn't considered the accessibility benefits of non-intrusive advertising or payments, I guess. It's not even advertising. It's just non-intrusive monetization. Anyway, it's cool. And like, and I had to like flip over my whole wallet to like upgrade my whole account and stuff like that. But I think I'm all set up and making money. So
nice. Which one did you use?
I'm on Uphold, which is,
That's what I'm on too.
I will say there was like a tiny like bit of frustration. Like I signed up for the thing and then I signed up for, I signed up for Coil, right? And I give them money. And then I signed up for, and they give me a plugin. And then I signed up for XRP Tipbot or something. And that's supposed to hold my crypto. And like, I was like, this is cool. But then they're like, XRP Tipbot's basically like, this was just a side project. It didn't mean to be big.
Yeah, the same thing happened to me with me. I picked Stronghold as my one, and then eventually got an email that just said, nope, we're closing this. Sorry. And I was like, oh, cool. But fortunately for me, I had also signed up for Brave's thing, their little attention token, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that only worked. That didn't support Stronghold. It only supported Uphold. So I was like, fine, I'll have Uphold too. They don't cost anything. So I was like, whatever. I'll just have an account. It'll just sit in one password. I'll check it every 2 years. You know, big deal.
Right.
But now Coil supports Uphold too. So now I have them both kind of barfing into the same account, which does feel a little better. But I heard, you know, PPK just was like furious about all this, just kind of like, why would I pick one service over the other? What's with all this slang? What the hell? You know?
Yeah.
I don't even know what an XBP is, you know, like it is very, he called it user hostile. And I almost think that's fair. Like I didn't feel that way only because I have no stake in this. This isn't life and death me. It was a little dumb game hobby, it felt like, when I set it up. So I didn't care that much. If it like mattered to my livelihood, then I would care. And because this is money, probably people do care. And so I think his criticism is fair.
And I think Leonie makes the point too. This only works if everyone does it. So it's, and that's it too. Like no one's going to make any money until everyone does it, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, PPK's points, you know, it's a lot of little tools to get kind of just to get money. But one thing I like about this Uphold switch is it actually keeps track of your collections over time. Because I wasn't getting that in XRP Tipbot. I was only getting like a total amount. And so I just was like, but now it's like, oh, you made one penny today. And it's like, oh, cool. That'll just go in my penny bucket. So
right.
It's my swear jar.
I have some strong points to make about this, though. Because if people are, this concept of sprinkling pennies around has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a model that's going to work. You heard it from me. I feel very strongly about that. Like, I know, you know, Leonie Watson signed up. She's going to get some pennies out of this, whatever. This is not, overall, the long-term player is not a sprinkle pennies around to your friends model, because that's not transformative or interesting or anything. Like, that's not going to work. That's what Coil is right now, but it's not, but it's just a, like a proof of concept foundation. The long-term play here is that this is a web standard. So it's not going to be just Coil. In fact, Dave and I could start another one too. And the smart way to do it, if Dave and I started boil.com or something that was the same thing, we could also collect your $5 or however much you want to give it us. And we could implement some cool tech or something to do this. But the play would be that we'd use the same meta tag. We'd do it the same way they do it. It's just that we'll be in charge of having the technology to sprinkle the money out or whatever. So if it's a standard, then there's not just Coil. There's other sites built around it, and that will happen if it's a real web standard. So these meta tags are, they're not standardized yet, but it looks like they probably will be, because it's not asking that much of web browsers. Really, I shouldn't say that. It probably is very complicated, but the meta tag itself isn't that bad. It's one line of code. It says, this points to this wallet. And so now there's a programmatic connection between that website and that wallet, and do what you will with that information. You know, it's kind of like a public key kind of approach. So now there's an open connection between the site and the wallet. If you have some service like Coil or Boil or Doyle or anything, and you've set it up in your browser to say, I want to give that site $5, not just a penny, but like you can tip it or control it in some actual way. That site then has APIs. So it's not just a meta tag, but it opens up this world of JavaScript APIs that I can ask questions to. I can say, is this user giving me any money at all right now? Yes or no, Boolean?
Yeah.
And then you can respond to that and be like, oh, they are giving you money? Then I won't show ads or anything. And by the way, this is all anonymous, right? Which makes this very appealing. I didn't have to type in my credit card. I didn't have to do stuff. It's like services are handling this. Makes it a lot easier to implement. I could even say, hey, has this user given me $5 this month? They have. Well, then they're on a whole other tier. Have they given me $10? Yes. Oh, then unlock stuff for them. Give. It kind of can be an actual, the way that you have an account on sites. I mean, that could be how you have CodePen Pro someday. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely not ready for that today. But that's the actual play here. This isn't a penny sprinkling play. This is like a, let's make paying stuff on the web a heck of a lot easier and anonymous and powered by cool technologies. That's kind of the bigger idea. And I think Coil is smart. They have this blog post called the 100 plus 20 rule, which is like, if you want this like ecosystem to be good and happen, it's like, don't take away stuff from people right now. Like if you're Dave Rupert, don't like publish half your blog post and then say to read the other half, you have to be web monetized. Because mm-hmm. that's more of like a 50-50 rule, you know, read mm-hmm. half the blog post, get the other half blog post. They're saying, don't take anything away, give 100, but give some bonus thing to people. That's the 20 for web monetization. So like in the case of CSS Tricks, I don't do the take away the advertising thing. And I have all kinds of opinions about that as well. I don't think it's ready for that either. But it is ready to unlock little dumb stuff. For example, I haven't implemented this either because it's not quite ready for this technologically. But I could say, like, if you use web monetization, then unlock this link. There'll be a URL on all my videos that allows you to download the video.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bonus. That's a little bonus on top of the fact that you could already watch the video. Now you can download it. And I could do that with very little code, you know? And the reason I haven't is because I don't want to unlock it to somebody that gave me a penny. I want to unlock it to somebody who gave me a dollar. And that's not ready yet.
That's economic-wise, like somebody who gives you a penny, it'll cost you more to send them a video, like in bandwidth, you know? Like,
it absolutely will, yeah.
So like, how do you get people at different levels? You know, I guess that's the question, you know, like even if it's dollar a month or whatever, I don't know, like it would be cool if all this was tied in, you know, I don't know, upgrade options or something like that. So, I don't know. I'm kind of curious how it's going to work.
Another thing for me is that it has to be fast, 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 super fast. It has to be like the user lands on the page and right away these APIs are available for me that tell me about that user. Like, does this user give me a dollar? Are they paying me? How much have they paid me? All this type of stuff. I can't wait 290 milliseconds or whatever. I mean, maybe that long would be fine. I'm sure there's some thresholds, but I definitely can't wait 5 seconds to find that out. It's too long.
Because if you do the ad flip, too, right? Like you want to inject the ad if they have it or they don't, they're not paying you money or something. That's like the common one, right? Like, oh, you're web monetized, no ads.
And ideally I'd like, if that's the case, I want to know in the first like 10 milliseconds.
Right.
Like, you know,
you have to know that because like, if it's doesn't like, if you don't like, I don't know, ads have requirements, like literal requirements on when they have to show up. But like, yeah, if you like, you're like, I don't know, you can save a lot of bandwidth, but like, if you have to wait then to show the ad might never show, you know, by the time like, or there's right. a huge.
So if you're going to do this today, like shift. You want to do this today, you want to do if web monetized, then don't show ads. You technically can. The tech is there for that. But the way to do it without shooting yourself in the foot would be to request the ads anyway, inject the ads anyway, wait as long as it takes for them to respond to yes or no at web monetized, and then remove the ads if they're monetizing you. And that's not a hell of a valuable proposition to make, because by that time you maybe you've already seen the ads, they've already done whatever performance hit they're going to do on the page, they've already done whatever tracking stuff they're going to do on the page. That's not that valuable. What you'd want to tell people is, I'm not going to show you nothing. This page will be absolutely free of that universe if you're web monetizing me, but in order to do that, I have to wait. You know, the speed of the response of web monetization is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay. Well, we talked about that now.
Yeah, no, I could. I mean, I'd like to get into it, but you know, I'm also interested too. Like, you just put that how to give me money section. I think we talked about in the last episode how to give me money, basically. And that's like a question we've asked on the Shop Talk show since the beginning of time. Like, how do we give you money? You know, like, yeah. I'm kind of interested in that. I don't have that exactly. I mean, I guess you can hire my company, but like, you know, like, how do you give me money? Like, I think that's like the coolest way to be like, here's what I provide. Like, you know, here's how you can give me money and support this blog. And that's probably even better than.
Don't you love the idea that you don't have to type in your name, your credit card number, nothing. You could just be like, oh, this website, I'm going to give it a couple of bucks. Boom. And you just
I do love that. Yeah. So maybe the coil is part of that how to give me money sort of section or whatever. Maybe I'll make that on my website. Just like how you can support me, and, you know, and it could be a Patreon. It could be a coil. It could be a, you know, click an ad, you know, or whatever. I don't know. Like, I don't know. That's interesting.
Pretty cool. I'm going to pick a random one here to do because we have a little more time. Just a little. Last one. Matthew Incardata here. Incardona. Hi, Matthew. I'm a web designer from New York, currently going to school for computer engineering. Recently, I've been taking a semester off and possibly dropping out to pursue a career in full stack development. The school I'm going to is great for engineering, but not so much for full stack. So I'm weighing it out. The 40K I'll have to be in debt to the uncertainty of leaving and teaching myself. So I don't know. What do you think of someone teaching themselves full stack, or what are the obstacles for making it in this career? So stay in school or go for it?
I would stay in school. I mean, like, this sounds like a very targeted program, right? Or is it kind of not?
I don't know. 40K, like, that's not a full 4-year degree, is it? Probably not.
No. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
We don't know enough about your school, Matthew.
Yeah, like, I guess going to school for computer engineering. Okay.
I'd probably stay in school, too.
I would probably stay in school. I mean, like, it's a lot of debt and stuff, but, like, I don't know personally. Maybe I do. I don't know a lot of people who, like, went to school and are... Like, you know, maybe I'm wrong here. I'm trying to think of like people I know who are like crushed by their college debt. I know some people who are, but they like did a lot of like private school or whatever, or like master's education and stuff like that. So I'm trying to think of like, you know, like I feel like the idea is you net out and you make that money back to pay back your degree, especially with something like engineering. I mean, if you're worried about it, you know, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a financial question. I would maybe figure out a way, like, take stock and figure out a way that you have something, like you have 3/4 of a degree or something like that. I don't know. And like, could you apply those credits and get your degree at a way cheaper university or something like that? Is there like another option to like just finish out and get the paper? But you know, financial stress is tough. I mean, like, 'cause it's wrapped up into like how you're feeling and stuff like that. But I feel like if you were able to land a job and budget heavily, you know,
yeah,
I think paying out that 40K, it's a lot, I'm saying, but like, I think you would be able to do it. So, and having a piece of paper from a university probably opens a few more doors.
It's like, we don't know enough about Matthew's life, right? Like, why jumping out of school? Is it 100% because you think the school part is a waste of time, or is it because you need to like jumpstart on some bucks because you need some bucks like now?
Yeah. Well, if you were like, I'm thinking about going to school, I don't know, I would probably advise you the opposite, to like just dip your toes into full stack and see if you can get some jobs, you know? I know a lot of people who have done code camps and stuff like that, and it's about the 40K mark, I think, for those, you know? They're making money and they got a job and they switch careers and stuff like that. So I think it's like worked out for them. So I think I know a lot more it worked out stories, getting the degree, getting the education, than I know, man, that was a total waste of money and now I'm in super debt. So that's what I guess it just, you can flip on the news and you'll see a lot of people worried about they're crushing school loans. So I don't want to diminish that at all, whatever. That's like very serious, but like, but specifically for like engineering loans, I think it sort of works out. I don't know. I could be wrong. So I'd love to see data.
Yeah. Good luck, Matthew. If you feel like telling us some more information about what's going on in your life and the school, that would be interesting. If other people are in this situation too, feel free to write in with your situation. This is a pretty common question we get at Shop Talk Show. And I think a lot of them are similar to this. They like, you want to keep the question short, which generally I highly appreciate on this program. You know, like you're sometimes a 5-paragraph question we can't run because it's just it's too long. So if it's really that your question is like, what do you think about Kubernetes or something, that's probably easier to run, even though I wouldn't have a good answer to that. But in this case of school, it's kind of like a love letter kind of thing. Like, we need more information about like the dynamics of what's happening with you to help kind of guide the situation. In this case, we know so little about your current situation, Matthew. It's hard to weigh in exactly, but with what we do have, Dave and I are both staying in school.
Yeah. And I would love to hear if you have a story, like I dropped out of school and got self-taught myself full stack and I'm way better off for it. Like, I would love to hear that story. I would read that blog post, you know, like this worked out for me, or like, you know, I think that's a cool story. So like, yeah. And if you stayed in school too, like, and it worked out for you or didn't work out for you and now you're mad at us, let us know. I can't. This is just an advice podcast. So I apologize.
But. Yeah, indeed. Don't let us ruin your life. Okay.
All right. We should wrap it up. Thank you, dear listener, for dropping out of college and downloading this. Be sure to star our favorite up. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Yell at us about your degree. And head on over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs to get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, shoptalkshow.com.